это война.
Уважаемые граждане, просьба разойтись.
Россия! In a rough-and-tumble working-class neighborhood in Moscow, an argument between two men, perhaps over a woman, turns violent and ultimately deadly. When it's over, 25-year-old Yegor Shcherbakov is dead of stab wounds. Media reports suggest the assailant was a man of, quote, non-Slavic appearance, leading nationalists to conclude that he was a migrant worker. Chanting Russia for Russians and white power, groups of nationalists and football hooligans, many of them drunk, storm and ransack a shopping center and vegetable market days later, searching for the alleged perpetrator. They overturned cars, they smashed windows, police arrested hundreds of rioters, but almost all of them have since been released. In the following days, they also detained more than 1,000 migrant workers, many of whom faced deportation. They also arrested an Azerbaijani man and charged him with killing Shcherbakov. Meanwhile, the bodies of an Uzbek and Azerbaijani man, both stabbed to death, were found in the vicinity of the rioting. This time it was in Moscow's Biryulyovo district, but we've seen this familiar scenario play out before. In the southern Russian town of Pugachev this past summer, in downtown Moscow in December 2010, and in the northwestern city of Kondopoga back in 2006. What's driving this ethnic rage? What are its political implications, and how far will it go? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
Biryulyovo, Pugachev, Kondopoga, these incidents tend to spring up periodically, and the script is usually the same. An ethnic Russian is killed in some kind of altercation with an ethnic minority, and then the riots, or dare I call them pogroms, begin. To get the ball rolling, I wanted to play a clip from Vera Elparovich, an analyst with the Sova Center, which monitors ethnic relations in Russia. She spoke to RFERL in the wake of the violence in Pugachev, which erupted this past summer, after a half-Russian, half-Tatar man was stabbed to death in a fight with a Chechen teenager. Let's listen.
Such incidents happen two or three times a month in reality. I follow the news reports of the Russian nationalists, and they never miss a conflict of this type. They try to emphasize them and publicize them and report on them. For them, these conflicts are signs that an inter-ethnic war is beginning, a war that they say must happen in Russia, that they are eagerly awaiting.
David, how explosive do you see this situation when you have nationalist groups on the lookout for any case where a non-Russian kills a Russian so they can exploit it and turn it into a pretext for a riot or a pogrom? Because that's what that's what Elparovich seemed to be saying was going on here, and it does ring true.
Well, it's very worrying, and obviously there are people in Russia who would like nothing better than to provoke more of these mass disorders. But what's really a problem is not the behavior of what are still a limited number of extremists, but rather the indifference of society as a whole and the failure of the political leadership to clarify just how necessary migrants are to Russia, to the Russian economy, to the well-being of Russian society, and how natural it is that they emigrate in search of a better life. This is the real problem. Under the conditions in which Russians are presently operating, there's no reasoned and intelligent response to the extremists. And under these circumstances, all kinds of misinformation is spread and prejudices are fostered.
And it seems, I would even push it further than that, the authorities seem to be not only treating the nationalists with kid gloves in this. I mean, if you contrast how they responded to Bolotnaya and what happened here, you know, I mean, I think two of them maximum have been charged with anything after what happened last weekend. And some have even suggested that this was to a degree orchestrated by those who would have liked to have taken over this this vegetable market. And I mean, I know Sean wrote about this week. It was written about by our own Russian service here. So it could have, I mean, it's not only that the authorities aren't articulating the need for migrants. The migrants are part of a corrupt network, and maybe it's not in anybody's interests for this to be brought out to for the system to be made more legitimate. No,
I think there's a realization on the part of the political authorities that the inter-ethnic tensions in Russia can be used for political purposes, and they're very reluctant to give up something that could prove to be so useful for them. Even if they understand in their more rational moments that the migrants are necessary to Russia and perform a very positive role, and it's not the authorities alone. There are members of the opposition who similarly are aware of the potential for exploiting these anti-immigrant sentiments.
And we'll be talking about one of those members of the opposition in the course of this podcast, to be sure. Sean, what are your thoughts?
I mean, nationalism, Russian nationalism, is a very tricky thing in Russia, because the authorities do dabble in it, absolutely. They have to play to it because their constituency is Russian. But at the same time, I think that they're very afraid of Russian nationalism, especially when it gets out of control like this. So I don't really accept the idea that the authorities certainly use Russian nationalism in certain contexts. But I think that one of the reasons why we see, you know, quote-unquote kid gloves being used is because the worst thing they can be shown on television is Omonci beating on regular working-class Russians in defense of migrants. So I think this is, like I said, I think this is a very, very touchy subject for a Russian national identity. And one of the things that's disturbing to me is the attitude amongst Russians that they feel that they're a nation without a state. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that I think this protest, for the most part, if in the kind of wider, deeper context, this is a protest against a multi-ethnic state, a protest against the fact that Russia is a conglomerate of many ethnicities and religious confessions. And Putin himself has pointed this out many times. I personally don't think Putin is a Russian nationalist. He's Russocentric, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But he has to play to this multi-ethnicity of the country, because inter-ethnic tensions and, as we've seen, inter-ethnic violence is a very, very serious matter. And we're seeing more and more of these kind of larger explosions, not to say about the general kind of ethnic tensions between individual people within the streets of Russia's cities.
How far do you think this can go? I mean, because we've seen this kind of ugliness in Russia in the past. Julia Yoffe wrote on a piece in the New Republic this week, so the headline of which was quite provocative: Russians still love their pogroms. And her closing sentence in the piece, I'm not quoting it verbatim, but it's along the lines of, "To my Jewish readers, now you understand why your ancestors left Russia."
Right, and in a lot of the, one of the contexts for the violence, of course, is the corruption that you've pointed out. Russians feel that this, because the migrant labor is so corrupt, it's within a web of mobsters, but also police taking bribes, giving protection to people who are employing migrant labor. It feeds into the perception amongst Russians that the state isn't working in their favor, that the state is really protecting corrupt people against the Russian people. Well, yeah. And this has a very, very long history. I mean, a lot of ethnic conflict is, I mean, if you think of the pogroms in 1905, they were around similar issues, that Jews were exploiting Russians and the Russian state wasn't stepping up and protecting Russians as Russians.
Mm. But in reality, in this situation, you point out to something very important here, and it's something I wanted to try to get at in this, is the legitimate concern about the criminality that does surround the whole migrant issue, and not migrants per se, but the fact that if these markets are in fact protected by political authorities and by police, they all have krishas. They all have usually ethnic Russian gangs that are reaping the lion's share of the profits from them. But the people that your average Russian sees are is not that. It is the migrant labor, and they've come to the conclusion that this is some migrant mafia that's robbing Russians. There are legitimate concerns around this issue because there is a lot of illegal migration to Russia, but there is also a reluctance to create a system that was a little bit more legitimate and above board. David, what can you say to that? Is it possible to separate this xenophobia, which is ugly and should be condemned, from legitimate concerns about the criminality surrounding this whole enterprise?
Well, the criminality that surrounds this enterprise is the criminality that surrounds the entire society. It's not just in relation to migrants that there's corruption and bribery. Those things exist at every level of the society from top to bottom. And the migrants are a convenient scapegoat, and they inspire a quite irrational response on the part of some people, in part because, and if we go back again to the example of the pogroms at the turn of the 20th century, there's a deeply rooted tendency in Russia to seek a scapegoat outside of them, for Russians, outside of themselves. I mean, the Jews served that purpose at one point. Migrants serve it at the present point. People from the Caucasus have also played that role. The rigidity of Russian thinking is oftentimes reflected in a failure to see the source of their problems. And when people are psychologically organized that way, it's quite natural to look for an external source of their problems. It's one of the reasons why Putin has launched the anti-American campaign that he has, because this is another way of distracting people from what's going on in their own society and faults, social and political faults in which they, to some degree, participate.
Sean, what do you think? What about this separating the legitimate? Because I think David has raised some good points there.
I mean, the corruption in this entire system of migration, I mean, David's right in this, that it's representative of an entire system of corruption that permeates throughout the Russian society. I mean, that's absolutely true. But in the migrant situation in particular, in some respect, there's nothing incredibly unique about this in Russia. I mean, certain aspects of the violence is unique, but, you know, dealing with migration is one of the major problems throughout certainly the Northern Hemisphere, of people who are mostly from either Africa, Middle East, or Asia, migrating as laborers into European, quote-unquote, or even white society. And Europeans and Russians and to some extent Americans feeling a lot of unease, the fact that they feel like they're being besieged by migrants, is that it's completely disgusting in many, many ways. But it is in a way a reaction against globalization in general. The fact that, you know, capitalism needs migrant labor, it needs cheap labor, and that cheap labor is coming from places that many people in, say, Russian society fear, mostly Muslims. You don't see the same outrage about Ukrainian and Moldovan migrants, and they're a great percentage of migrants coming in for cheap labor, right?
Right, but they're not noticed as much,
They're not noticed as much because they're Slavic. I mean, even Navalny says this. He doesn't make an issue about Ukrainians because they're part of this, quote-unquote.
He's half Ukrainian.
he puts them as part of, a kind of great grander Orthodox Christian. They're not Muslims. I mean, he makes a clear demarcation between migrants who come from, say, Ukraine or Moldova and migrants that come from Central Asia and the Caucasus.
At least implicitly does. Now, you wrote a very, very interesting piece that just went up yesterday or today, if I'm not mistaken, about how this whole incident it was used as almost as a pretext for a classic, Pitadil Sopsnesi. It's been the RFRL's Russian service has done a lot of excellent reporting on this, as well as has some of the Russian press. In fact, Rosbalt, a piece you linked to, quoted an unidentified law enforcement official as saying this whole thing, we have no doubt that this whole riot was orchestrated. They said it had a director, Bill Regisseur. And now, I certainly don't buy into the conspiracy theory that from the start this was an orchestrated thing, but it certainly does seem to make a lot of sense that after the fact, the authorities are using this as a pretext to pursue the economic goals of people associated with the Klan now in power in Moscow, i.e. Sobyanin's people, are trying to get control of a pretty lucrative piece of real estate. So this adds yet another piece of this puzzle, doesn't it?
Yeah, certainly. And I to restate, too, I don't buy into the fact that this riot was a conspiracy orchestrated by people who want to seize the Pokrovsky market. But it certainly it's being used after the fact,
yes.
Right?
And you write that very clearly.
Yeah, it could be used after the fact. I mean, here what has happened? I mean, the Russian government's response to the riots as multi-levels. I mean, what did they do? They did what they did in late July. They go after migrants.
Right.
You know, they start rounding up migrants. And in this case, they're actually using – I just read this morning that they're going to start Friday raids of migrants, and they promise to raid every apartment, check every apartment in Moscow by December 31st for migrants. How are they going to pull this off?
Every
I don't know.
Apartment in Moscow?
Every apartment in Moscow. So this is what the Kommersant article said.
Goodness.
But nonetheless, you know, after the fact, I mean, what did they do? They went to and arrested the director of this warehouse, and they're looking for one of the majority shareholder of Novy Cheryomushki, the company that owns this warehouse. And this smells like a classic case. What happens is you arrest the owners or the proprietors of an enterprise. And after that, once you have them in prison, you can start working to seize the property.
Right.
And this property has been under dispute for a very long time. I mean, it's been the mob has tried to control these markets. I mean, as we know, it's a big criminal enterprise. And, you know, this is a 5,000-hectare space. And it could be used for all sorts of things. And already coming out of Sobyanin's office, there's talk about moving all of these warehouses outside the MCAD freeway.
Right.
So, and then the question is, well, then what happens to the property?
Right. And it should be noted also that the current owners are who are now under assault were allies of Yuri Lushkov, the former mayor of Moscow. And I would be willing to bet my last dollar that the new owners will be allies of Mr. Sobyanin. Your comment about the Kommersant piece where they're still talking about checking every apartment in Moscow. It recalls a story back in September of 1999 during the apartment bombings when they were going from apartment to apartment and checking everybody. They checked mine. But I remember an interesting story. One of my colleagues, another American working in Moscow, the police came to his door and they asked him if he'd seen any foreigners. And he said, well, yeah, every time I look in the mirror. And he showed him their passport. He was like, no, we don't mean you. They were looking for Chechens, who, I'm sorry, are not foreigners. They are citizens of the Russian Federation, which leads me to something I did want to discuss here, because foreign migrants and, for lack of a better term, citizen migrants, because every time I read in a news report about migrants from the North Caucasus, I want to scream, because they're not migrants. They're citizens of the Russian Federation working in their own capital. So this, I wanted to get at this issue of people from the North Caucasus tend to be lumped in with immigrants, illegal immigrants. David, why is that? And what could you say to that?
Well, this is the way the consciousness of the country has evolved. I mean, ever since the beginning of the First Chechen War, and certainly since the beginning of the Second Chechen War, sentiments in Russia against people from the North Caucasus have been very negative. There was a spike after Putin came into office, and the level of antagonism toward people from that region has remained at a very high level with very, very little variation up to the present day. I don't have the exact statistics with me, but something like 75-80% of Russians believe that persons from the North Caucasus should be limited in their rights, mm-hmm. that discrimination against them was justified. By the same token, the Caucasian republics themselves are being emptied, the North Caucasian republics are being emptied of Russians. They're becoming mono-ethnic. So a process is taking place. What people are expressing is a process that is taking place in the society and that may very well end with the North Caucasus separating from Russia at some point. In any case, there's no appreciation any longer on the part of most people that these are their fellow countrymen.
No, I mean, I've even heard statements from officials saying they're not Rossiyanini, which means they're not citizens of the Russian Federation. I've heard people calling on, and I don't know how this would work, but people from the North Caucasus are having to get visas to go to Russia. Well, I mean, I really, in practice, don't know how that would work.
It just shows the level of confusion, but it also is a demonstration of the incredible harm that was done to post-communist Russia by the Chechen wars. They really changed the consciousness of people, and they started a process that led to people from the North Caucasus being reclassified in the eyes of many Russians. They had been accepted in Soviet times as fellow countrymen, and when the Soviet Union fell apart, there was still this residual assumption that all of the people who lived on the territory then called the Russian Federation were citizens of one country. But that was one of the things that was lost in the years of senseless warfare.
But now, if you push that further, these people, the Russians, would not advocate Chechen independence, though, and the authorities would.
But many polls now show that, in fact, they would be perfectly happy to be rid of.
The whole North Caucasus
area.
But the authorities certainly wouldn't want to go along with that, which leads us to the situation that's almost colonial, if you will. Right? It's Sean.
Vasily Kuchevsky wrote, and I think it was in 1904, that Russia, the history of Russia, is a history of a country colonizing itself. it points. This is why I say that one of the kind of underlying issues of this riot is a protest against the multi-ethnic state. Mm. And this is a persistent problem throughout Russian history. I mean, whether it's the Tsarist Empire, the Soviet Union, or post-Soviet Russia, and that is that Russia is a federation of ethno-territorial units. Chechens have their own territorial unit. Dagestanis have their own territorial unit. Bashkirs have their own territorial unit. The only people who don't have a territorial unit by law are Russians. And this is bred into the – and this was the case under the Soviet Union, in particular in the early 1930s when Russians were in many cases discriminated against. It is proved, and Russian nationalism comes out of the idea of a confluence between the Russian nation and the Russian state. And they have the Russian nation and national consciousness, but not a state that coincides, say, like the German state, right? They want this kind of ethno-territorial state. And this exists at least in a structural way. And this is bred in the idea of Russians that they are... they don't have the same rights. However wrong this idea
is, fiction.
But this is what people believe. This is why you have this confluence between, you know, the fact that people from the North Caucasus, from Chechnya and Dagestani, have every right to be in Moscow, just like a Russian from Tambov.
Right.
But they see it different because they see that the Chechens and Dagestanis, or people from the North Caucasus in general, don't belong in the Russian nation. This is what the slogan "Russia for Russians" means,
right?
And this goes to a larger problem of the failure of Russia throughout its history to create a civic nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's something along the lines of a kind of Americanism. The Soviet Union, the Imperial Empire, tried to do this. And the Tsar was the capstone for this, right? Loyalty to the Tsar and the multi-ethnic empire under the Tsar. Soviet Union tried to do this with the concept of Soviet, right? Mm. You know, in many ways, the Russians were the unmarked, as one historian wrote, the unmarked Soviet people. So this kind of effort to create this this kind of federal identity, you know, was part of the Soviet project. And as David alluded to, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you lost this. And in my view, one of the things driving the search for the post-Soviet national idea is to create a civic nationalism based on Russia's multi-ethnicity and multi-confessional population.
No, I think that's bang on, and you kind of anticipated where I was about to go. I would add, though, in this situation, I mean, the Russian Federation is, if I'm not mistaken, over 85% ethnic Russian, if I'm not mistaken, according to the statistics. So this idea that the Russians don't have a territorial unit, it rings a bit absurd to me.
And if I may add something else, the idea that the authorities are not protecting Russians from migrant crime, right, feeds into this idea. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They are the vast majority of the population, but they feel like they're a colonized people.
Yeah, and if you look at the crime statistics, if you look at them, I'm sorry. I mean, over the last decade, there's been between 21 and 47,000 murders in Russia per year. It's down in the 20s now. Back in the early 2000s, it was closer into the 40s. The vast, overwhelming majority of those are either Russians on non-Russians. Non-Russians on Russians is a minuscule part of the crime. But when you got nationalist groups looking for anything to turn into a cause or being used to turn things into cause for somebody's political or economic purposes, you have a pretty explosive situation. You touched on exactly where I want to go before we go to the next segment, and that was when you brought up civic nationalism, or as I prefer to call it, civic patriotism, which I've said on the podcast before it's the thing that could get Russia out of this mess if this could ever be developed, in my opinion. And I want to listen to another cut from Alperovich from the Sova Center, who directly alludes to this when we spoke to her back in the summer. Let's listen to that.
In the absence of an overarching civic identity, there is a natural, customary tendency to relate to one's traditional ethnic identity. And then we begin to see the mechanisms of xenophobia and conflict, which particularly can be seen in small towns where there are tight communities and everything happens in plain sight.
Anybody want to comment on that before we move on?
Well, I think that this is a very important point, that because the country doesn't have firm values, it doesn't have democratic institutions, it's deprived of an anchor, and people seek that anchor in their ethnic identity. And this is why even it's oftentimes quite well-educated people are reluctant to think outside of those terms.
Right. What would have to happen? I mean, what are some of the things the authorities could actually do right now, do you think, to help foster a kind of civic patriotism that would take the wind out of the sails of this nationalism?
Well, one thing would be to provide what Kuril says repeatedly that Russia does not have, and that is an overarching ideology. An ideology that kind of binds the country together in some sort of present that describes the present, but also provides some kind of roadmap for the future. At least some kind of like we're progressing toward X, and we're trying to, even the idea of a Russian, Russian dream, like a take off the American dream.
The Russian dream.
To kind of pull the society and bind together in this kind of not based on this, Russia for Russians or even Chechens for Chechnya, but an overarching civic identity that binds the nation binds the country as a whole. And we see repeatedly that 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's either a reluctance or an inability to define what this civic identity is. And a lot of it does have to do with the fact that in terms of civic democratic institutions, they're completely atrophied in Russia. And when they develop, they get atrophied. These could possibly provide this kind of notion. Like, for example, the volunteerism that we saw around the Krim's flood last year is a perfect example of a civic identity,
Right. Or during the forest fires in the summer of 2010.
During the forest fires. Like these kind of – unfortunately, these natural disasters seem to pull the best attributes of Russian society up to the surface.
Russian citizens, not necessarily the Russian state.
Russian citizens. And this is one of the things I think in kind of developing these types of institutions, allowing for the political but also the civic participation of the country. And this is should be emphasized. This is one of the things that the Soviet system did. Whatever one may say about institutions like the Komsomol or all of these various political campaigns, this brought the citizenry into the participation of the country in some form or fashion. If you wanted to be a part of it, you could. And what we have today is nothing like that, that pulls society into kind of a voluntaristic civic participation in the betterment and the future of the country.
I would also argue, too, that a central component of civic patriotism, from somebody who considers himself a civic patriot, is pride in your institutions.
Yes. And
right now, Russians do not have a lot of pride in their political institutions, because your institutions are kind of your architecture and your infrastructure of citizenship in a lot of ways, and we don't, when that's absent and there's absent a unifying myth or unifying ideology which all societies have, whether it be it the American dream or something else, and then when you have this the state not only not encouraging voluntarism but actually trying to discourage it if they can't control it, then you have them not only not working for the creation of civic patriotism but actively working against it. David, last word before we move on to the next segment.
Well, the voluntarism under the Soviet regime was not really voluntary. I mean, you couldn't avoid being a participant. Because if you did, you would immediately be subject to suspicion and possible retaliation. And the voluntarism that was shown at the time of the Krimsk flood and the other natural disasters was a response to the fact that everyone knew that the government, having done nothing to prevent the flooding, would do nothing to rescue the victims if people themselves didn't respond. That, too, is a traditional response in Russia. People help each other because they can't count on any help from the society or government. But it's all ultimately an emanation of a state that's based only on guaranteeing the power of a handful of people who want to rule without society, without participation, without law. Mm.
On that note, we'll move on to the next section. In a few moments, we will shift gears and look at a related topic. Opposition leader Alexei Navalny had a pretty big week, and he also made some controversial comments about the violence in Beruliova. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including my personal favorite, Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Суд рассмотрев жалобу Алексея Навального и Петра Офицерова
на свободы условным сроком. Напомню,
Навальный считает приговор несправедливым и
Навальный опаснее для Кремля в тюрьме или на
свободе. Воровали и воровать будут.
Думаете, воры?
Будут.
It was indeed a big week for Alexei Navalny. An appeals court in Kirov suspended his 5-year sentence on embezzlement charges, widely seen as trumped up. And although the suspended sentence still bars him from running for office, he got his political party registered this week, and the consensus in the Moscow media thinks that this will be a temporary thing and he will definitely be involved in politics. But as far as the violence in Beruliova goes, Navalny had this to say.
I feel sympathy for those people, not just in Biryulova, but in other places too, like Marino or Ostozhenka, where people can't get justice. They can't get the police, the prosecutors, or the courts to protect them. That is why many people are forced to act radically if they want to achieve something. Of course, I don't like seeing cars burning or being turned over in the streets of Moscow. But the authorities themselves have sent a clear signal with their inaction over the last couple of days, paving the way for pogroms. They are ignoring killings. They are not investigating anything, but if there is a pogrom, they will fly in a helicopter and arrest everybody.
Navalny also called for a visa regime for countries of the South Caucasus and Central Asia and launched a petition online to get the issue before the State Duma. So two things are clear from this week. Navalny continues to be ascendant politically and I think will continue to ascend. And two, he continues to play the nationalist card without apology. Sean, your thoughts?
Yeah, I found his comments about the riot really kind of disgusting and unfortunate, and it shows that his democracy is really a Russian democracy, and it's not a democracy that seeks to incorporate all people of the Russian Federation. I think that's first. In trying to figure out Navalny as a politician and what he believes, I think in terms he's a Democrat, but he's a Russian Democrat first and foremost. And he did launch this petition for the visa regime. I checked it this morning. So far, he has 32,000 of the 100,000 needed to push this in anywhere forward. But yeah, in a lot of ways, as I would say, it was a kind of you get the bad Navalny with the riots. You also have the other Navalny, which is he avoided being sent to prison at the moment, and he got a suspended sentence. And it seems clear that the Kremlin has decided to allow him to play in the political arena. How far they're going to let him go, it remains to be unseen. But clearly, it shows that it kind of confirms something I said several weeks ago during the elections, is that you know Navalny can function, or at least some in the Kremlin see Navalny as a new foil for politics and something to kind of bolster, go against, compete against, and possibly bolster the legitimacy of the Russian political system.
One has to wonder if they're not playing with fire in a lot of different ways there. I mean, this is not Zhirinovsky. This guy's for real. And he I'm not sure who's going to be the master in that situation ultimately.
No, David, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. David, your thoughts?
Well, it is truly unfortunate that Navalny didn't have the wherewithal to explain to his followers and explain publicly that that the behavior of the rioters was in no way justified. And it would have been what I would have liked to have heard from him is some reference, for example, like one to the Tajik girl who was murdered in St. Petersburg in 2004. Right. Would Navalny have then justified a pogrom against Russians? Because it was some Russian criminals attacked this girl who was certainly far more defenseless than the person who was the victim in the attack in Berliuva.
Everybody's having trouble pronouncing that. No, it's a tongue twister, man.
Yeah, Berliuva. But this is the problem that I think what Navalny's remarks demonstrate is that no one is ready to speak honestly to the Russian people. I mean, even if this had been a murder which was racially motivated, it would not have been justified attacks directed against an entire group.
Right.
It was the act of an individual, and that individual needed to be punished. If there were going to be protests, they should have been directed against the police for their non-action, not against the market where the migrants were earning a living just like everybody else. And in fact, through their activities, making life better for everybody. Under these circumstances, really the situation for Russia is worrying, because the person who has become the leading opposition figure, the leading opponent of an corrupt and authoritarian regime, himself is playing to the worst instincts in the population. So in fact, makes himself liable to manipulation by the authorities, because they can use better than he the issues that he is posing in false terms.
And I think we can all agree that Navalny's reaction to this was a little bit disturbing, or at least all of us on this podcast can agree that his reaction was at best disappointing and at worst disturbing. But if you look at his website and on the for the visa regime, he links this up to his favorite theme of fighting Kremlin corruption, basically making the argument, the correct argument, I think, that the immigration system as it stands right now feeds corruption. He's linking these two issues, nationalism and anti-corruption, both of which do in fact resonate. So while this may be disturbing or disappointing, is it smart politics?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, in terms of the corruption and the sources of, you know, a lot of the issues with migrant labor, I mean, he's right. You know, the fact that we've already spoken about how corruption permeates this immigration issue, you know, the ability to get work permits is incredibly, even the legal migrant laborers to get work permits is an incredibly corrupt system itself, right? There's lots of paying, you know, payoffs changing hands. The operation of a lot of these businesses requires payoff, you know, the krisha, as you said earlier, by the police. So he's absolutely right in that. And it is very smart politics. And there is a, you know, if we're speaking in, you know, crass political terms, there is a place for journalism, I think, in anti-corruption activity, because it feeds into the idea that the Russian people are being besieged by their own state. Right, and they can't trust their, as we said earlier, they can't trust their institutions, because their institutions are there to kind of prey off of them.
Yeah, when I was looking at the comments, I was thinking, my first reaction was like, God, I wish he just would focus on the corruption aspect of it, because that's where the problem is, and say, we want to create a system that's going to be better for the migrants and better for Moscovites and better for everybody. But he mixed in this nationalism. Of course, because we're not his constituency, right? We are not his constituency. And what he is saying rings with, he made it ring to the broadest possible constituency. David?
Well, clearly he's trying to use the issue, but he does so at the expense of the country and the expense of the people that he's supposedly trying to help, because he's confusing them about what really is at stake. He's using the migrants and their situation as a scapegoat for the corruption in the country, which doesn't emanate from the migrants. It emanates from the regime.
Right.
And in order to fight against the regime, you have to confront the regime with a demand for decent values, which at the same time protects the migrants. So what he's doing is he's undermining the base, the moral base of his own opposition, with an opportunistic effort to take advantage of really the weaknesses and the prejudices of the Russian population. That's what's so disappointing, and it really disqualifies him, or will disqualify him, if he continues in the eyes of many people as any type of moral opposition.
Although he seems to be holding this coalition, if you will, so far together of his you know, middle class liberal supporters plus his nationalist supporters, can this hold?
I doubt it. I mean, he'll have to choose. Of course, it will. Neither side will be satisfied ultimately. I mean, if he. By taking it, this situation in Russia is likely to get worse, and it will impose on anyone who aspires to political leadership the obligation to be clear on where he or she stands. And if Navalny thinks it's to his advantage to in some way use the antagonism against the immigrants in order to gain power, all he'll find is that he undermines himself as an alternative to those who are already in power.
Sean, would you agree with that?
I mean, I don't see any contradiction between the liberal middle classes of Moscow and Russian nationalism. mm-hmm. can hold it together because they share many of his views. I mean, think about it. The people who are reading his blog and who are voting, you know, the 32,000 people who so far have voted for a visa regime, and note, only 760 have voted against it.
Right.
They're not residents of Belorova.
Right.
They are his constituency that he's been appealing to on the internet, you know, since he came to prominence. So, you know, they share a lot of the same views, and a lot of middle class Russians, academics even that I've talked to, share similar views too. They may not be as harsh.
Right. They're not going to storm a market and beat up foreigners.
Exactly. But they certainly ascribe to the idea that migrants are certainly a problem and they're changing the face of Russian society for the worse. So I think he can. And I've always felt the strength of Navalny was his ability to wed those two very things. Because, you know, and he's positioned himself as basically they don't have anyone else. All the other oppositionists have kind of faded from the scene.
Right.
It's quite incredible
how he's risen
and they've fallen.
It's all about Navalny in this sense. What he says now actually matters quite a bit, which is why we're paying so much attention to these. This is not the first time he's made comments about a situation like this. And that's before we wrap up. I wanted to talk about this little dance that's going on between Navalny and the Kremlin. I interpreted the verdict, the suspended sentence in Kirov today, as a pretext for continued negotiations between Navalny and the regime. Because what I think is happening right now is that the regime is trying to make Navalny into the new Rogozin. They're a little foil on the right that they can have and they can use and they can tame and they can use to let steam off in this whole farce of a managed democracy. But Navalny's playing his own game. And you got to wonder, again, like I said earlier, this ain't Zhirinovsky. This ain't somebody that's going to play by their rules. He's going to play by his rules, and he's going to get all the breathing space he can out of them. How do you see this, either of you, I guess, on this? How do you see this dance playing out right now? I mean, the Kremlin's trying to co-opt him. Can they housebreak him?
They may not even be trying to co-opt him. They may just be wary of making him even more popular than he is already. They want to neutralize him with the minimum amount of damage. They may have their own view of Navalny and of his personality and what their possibilities are of co-opting him or getting or neutralizing him in a manner that would be optimal. But under any circumstances, they don't want him as a political opponent in 2018, and they don't. They've effectively prevented that, and they don't want him as a martyr. Well, legally they have. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Because I'm looking at the direction where the trend arrows are pointing, right? His sentence was changed from a real sentence to a suspended sentence. That is, there's been talk that he might fall into this amnesty. It's coming up in the Duma for the 20th anniversary of the Constitution. That would put him back in the political arena full time. His party was registered this past week. His party was registered. So the trend arrows seem to be bringing him in as a kind of housebroken systemic opposition.
If he's not able to remove the present regime from power, he up to a certain point is actually advantageous to the regime. He provides a way for people to let off steam. It's to the advantage of this type of regime that tensions not build up to the point that they could cause an explosion. And Navalny does provide that kind of outlet. The danger for them comes if he, in fact, is capable really of taking power. And they've taken some steps to try to prevent that.
The operative word is try, but I'm
yeah.
Not...
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, no one has a crystal ball. Their actions reflect a certain amount of confidence that they can contain the challenge that Navalny represents. And under any circumstances, there's no guarantee that locking him up would make him less of a threat than he is under these circumstances.
Yeah, I'm not sure they know what to do with him. And from his perspective, Mark Eliade, I think, put it better than anybody, that Navalny's choice, basically, vis-a-vis this, the regime, is to either act as an insurgent, a la Lenin, or act as a midwife who will basically, you know, facilitate the birth of a new regime. Sean, do you think Navalny would be, by coming into the system, this would help facilitate him be a more effective midwife, if that is in fact the road he has chosen? And it looks like that is the road he has chosen. And you have to go back to his Bolotnaya speech where he says, "Trust me, I know what to do next." I was wondering what exactly he meant by that at the time, but it seems to me he meant, it's going to look like I sold out to the authorities, but I didn't really. So what do you think?
I think that there, certainly what his suspended sentence says is that within the Kremlin, there are various groups who are kind of have various positions on Navalny. One wants to put him in prison, one wants to use him as a foil, and one wants to co-opt his message. And Navalny, as you say repeatedly, is playing his own game. But I think even then, that own game has its limits within Russian politics. Navalny can play the institutions of Russian politics, getting votes, elections, mobilizing the population. But I think eventually, and this will be the real test as far as to see how far he can really go as a political force, at some point he's going to come up against the informal politics that really governs Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And how what deals he's going to have to make with certain members of even a technocratic liberal elite to secure their position, but also allow him to rise up and be this midwife that you're pointing to. And I think that that will be the real test of Navalny's popularity. If he can challenge and somehow undo the informal structures of Russian politics that every Russian politician in his own way, from, you know, Nicholas I to Stalin to Putin, tries to fight, but is always succumbed into the sistema. And if you haven't read Elena Ledineva's new book, this is a perfect look into this problem. Mm-hmm. At some point, they get sucked into the sistema and have to play by its rules. And this will be the test for him.
And you have to wonder if those negotiations, informal as they may be going on as we are speaking right now. David, very last word to you before we wrap it up for this week, if you want to have the last word.
Well, I don't object to having the last word. I mean, I can only emphasize that Navalny, if he begins to capitalize on racism and nationalism, will step down a road that will not lead to a better result for Russia, because he will be taking advantage of tendencies that are traditional in society and that actually need to be eradicated. So we'll see, you know, how it all plays out. But it is a very worrisome fact that the person who has emerged as the principal opponent of the regime demonstrates this type of tendency. It reminds me very much of the misgivings that I had about Yeltsin, even under Gorbachev, his authoritarian tendencies, the way in which he begged Gorbachev for forgiveness when he was removed as first secretary of the Moscow Party Committee, removed from the Politburo. All of these things, which, you know, they're micro symptoms, which, you know, can be dismissed at an early stage. At a later stage, they become very important indeed.
Well, yeah, and I would add to that that because of the position Navalny's in right now, that he has placed himself in Russian politics right now, and the important role I think he's poised to play in it, everything he says right now is going to be scrutinized, and for very, very good reason. And that is all we have time for today, folks. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I'd
also like to thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the super cool Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.